Thank you for joining us today. I have a very special guest with me working with Houston Baptist University. We have had some amazing opportunities in the last couple of years to talk to some very interesting folks. And Scott, who is joining us today, is one of those very interesting people we have an opportunity to work with today. Scott Stripling is with Houston Baptist University. He's working with a new exhibit that they're hosting at the Bible Museum there. It is a exhibit of archaeology, and it is going to be something fascinating we'll get to hear about in this next few minutes. Scott, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, Marcia, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity.
Now, you're working with HBU right now, but your full-time job actually is with Wharton College, is that right?
That's correct. I am the head of the Humanities and Foreign Language Department at Wharton County Junior College, and we're thrilled to be working in partnership with HBU on this exhibit.
Now, you have another interesting job as well as an archaeologist.
Well, that's right. That's my avocation or main passion, but I'm able to spend about a month in the summer and a month in the winter between semesters in Israel, working on various projects, but primarily our dig at Kirbet El Makadar.
You know, I automatically have to picture you now as Indiana Jones. I'm sorry. I think that's most
people.
Well,
you wouldn't be the first. I was speaking recently at a civic group, and they did sort of a spoof video and took some footage of Dr. Jones and put my face on him, and so that's a common thing to do.
I guess that's our only exposure to archaeology is through the movies. Between that and Jurassic Park, that's where I get my images of archaeology. But it's interesting because your dig is not in Israel. Where exactly are you digging?
Well, we are in Israel, 10 miles north of Jerusalem.
Okay.
Actually, in what's called Security Zone C, which is the West Bank or the disputed territory. So, depending on someone's politics, they might describe that as Palestine, and others might describe it as Israel.
Interesting part of the world to be working in. We have an opportunity in October that we're hosting a tour. KKHT will be hosting a tour to Israel, and I cannot wait to go. And part of that, I think, that most people want to go to Israel is because there's such a history of our Bible facts in Israel, that you're digging up truth about what's happening in the Bible in Israel as you go about your career, aren't you?
Well, it's actually quite fascinating. It's what I call synchronisms. It's where the archaeological data and the ancient text, the biblical text, converge. And so we can see something like, say, the walls of Jericho being described, and then we can see the archaeological record, or the destruction of the city of Ai, and then we can look at the archaeological record and see the two come together. And it really does illuminate and helps us not only apologetically, but hermeneutically as well.
Well, tell us about, let me see if I can get this right. It's Kirbet El Makadar?
That's not bad for a Texas girl.
Thank you. Tell me about the site. What's the history there?
Well, the site is very interesting. It begins with Abraham, excuse me, around the year 2000 BC, coming to the hill between Bethel and Ai, or Ha'ai, the ruin, and building an altar there and calling upon the name of the Lord in Genesis 12. Mm-hmm. And then in Genesis 13, of course, we have the story of Abram and Lot parting ways from the hill between Bethel and Ai. Well, the Eye of Abraham's day, we know, is at a site called Et Tel. The issue is that the name apparently migrated over the centuries to a nearby site, and it was already in ruins by the time that Abraham had been there anyway. But the site of Kirbet El Makadar would have been the hill between Bethel and Ai in Abraham's day.
Mm-hmm.
By the time of Joshua, the Late Bronze Age, it had, as I said, migrated, and this happens fairly commonly in the biblical world and in the modern world. For example, you have Old Testament Jericho and New Testament Jericho a couple mm-hmm. of miles away, and that's what we think happened at Kirbet El Makadar. We have this Late Bronze Age fortress from the time of Joshua that we've been excavating since 1995 with Associates for Biblical Research. And we believe we've found ample evidence of this being the Eye of Joshua's day. And then Fast forward to the early Roman period, or the time of Jesus, 1st century B.C., 1st century A.D., we have a magnificent little village that's never been touched and is kind of a laboratory for understanding New Testament times that we might possibly associate with Ephraim of John 11:53 and 54. And then finally, a Byzantine church and monastery was built there in the 4th century.
That's so amazing. I can't imagine what it's like to be walking in a place where you believe Abraham walked and Joshua walked. And then as you begin to dig, what's it like for you as an archaeologist and a believer to unearth something that really tells you you are in that place?
Well, it's really sort of what makes it all come together. You know, we take the two disciplines of theology and archaeology, and when those artifacts shed light on the biblical record, or in some cases even confirm the biblical record, that's as good as it gets. I mean, that's why we do what we do, and partially it's because we've had so many people who, I guess with agendas from the left, have tried to, with everything they could, prove that the Bible was irrelevant or inaccurate, and that just simply hasn't been borne out by our experience in the field.
And so your science helps prove the Bible so often, or it does prove the Bible as you go about just doing your scientific discovery.
Well, that's right. In fact, we've never seen an instance where it did not. Now, there are times where there's silence in the archaeological record, and we sort of have a maxim that we use that goes like this: absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And so there are times, there's many reasons why things could be missing from the archaeological record. For example, Abraham in the patriarchal period, well, good luck finding evidence of Abraham, because people who lived in tents didn't leave an imprint in the archaeological record.
That's true. You can't find his name subscribed to something there.
No, we haven't found his tent pegs yet.
Yeah. You know, it's there's a seminar that's coming up, and of course the exhibit itself is open right now at the Houston Baptist University. They have this beautiful Bible museum there, the Dunham Bible Museum, and the exhibit opened on the 21st of January and will be open through the year, a special exhibit where you can go and enjoy the opportunity to see the artifacts from the excavation site. And on the February 8th date, there is a symposium that will be going on the site, along with and biblical archaeology in general. And you, Dr. Stripling, are one of the speakers that day. So that's going to be interesting. You're talking about ritual purity at the site and the first Jewish revolt against Rome. So what was that like?
Well, I'll be focusing on the early Roman village, or the New Testament village, at the site. And what we have found is just incredible evidence of their obsession with ritual purity that began in the 1st century B.C. and carried on into 70 A.D. when, of course, the Great Revolt was crushed by the Romans. And so we have ample evidence of this ritual purity, from the mikvot, which they used for ritual immersion and purification, to the stoneware which they were using, and the types of lamps. And I'll be talking about all of these things that were part of how the people in Jesus' day viewed ritual purification, and some of the things that he directly mentioned. Hopefully we can shed light on those.
So you and your team, you've uncovered these different pieces of pottery and things like that, and understand that to be part of that ritual purity process, and have brought those to HBU where people can actually see them and hear the story behind
them. And in fact, there was a transition that occurred right around the time of Herod the Great, 1st century B.C., where certain types of pottery disappear from the archaeological record, what we call Eastern Terracidgelata ware. No longer appears at these Judean or Galilean sites, and they're replaced with what we call stoneware, which they believed was less susceptible to becoming ritually impure. And so I'll be showing examples of that and talking about that topic in depth.
So when you first go to the site, you were on the very beginning of the excavation, is that right?
I was not there in 95.
Okay.
I have been at the Makadar dig for the last 5 years.
For the last 5 years. So the dig is underway when you come in. So were you brought in for your specialty, or was this something
I was a generalist and brought in to provide supervision. and helped supervise a couple of the fields that we're excavating, because we divide the site into a grid which has various fields. But we've been very fortunate since the inception to have the dig under the direction of Dr. Bryant Wood, who is a legend in the field of biblical archaeology, and he'll be one of our speakers on February the 8th. But we're just transitioning as of the first of this year, where Dr. Wood is stepping down, and I'm taking his place with some big shoes to fill director of the excavation.
How big is the
but
site?
Fortunately, Dr. Wood's going to continue to work with us as our ceramic typologist and so forth.
Oh, that's good. So how big a site are we talking about?
Well, it's actually only about, in the late Bronze Age, the time of Joshua, 2.5 acres, maybe 4 acres during the early Roman period. That's within the walled village, of course. Many of the inhabitants lived outside the walled area as well. So it's a relatively small site, which, of course, Bible readers would pick up on the fact that Ai was considerably smaller than Jericho.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, our site is considerably smaller than Jericho.
How far down do you have to dig before you start to hit pay dirt?
Well, that's what a kerbet is as opposed to a till. A kerbet is a ruin that doesn't have the profile of a till, where you have sort of the layering, classical layering of a till.
Mm-hmm.
A kerbet is where you're actually seeing the ruins sticking up from the surface.
Really?
So, there are some areas on the site where there was nothing ever built on top of the late Bronze Age material, like, you know, the gate was easily accessible, and mm-hmm. the socket stones of the gate, which are actually at the HBU exhibit. And then another part of the site was then covered about, 1,400 years later, after its destruction, another city was built on top of part of that, and that's the New Testament village that I'm discussing. So in that case, we go through about 2 meters of material from New Testament times before we then get into the material from
Testament.
The late Bronze Age, the
That's
time
not
of
really
Joshua,
that far.
Which is, you know, what is so interesting, because when we get below floor level in these structures, that's when we begin to find the better preserved LB material, and that's what led to our big discovery last summer.
What is the big discovery? I was going to ask you, what's the most exciting thing you've found so far?
Well, according to Christianity Today, they just released their top 10 finds for 2013 in the field of archaeology, and we would have been thrilled to be anywhere on the list of the top 10, but we were just overjoyed to see that we're number one on the list.
Wow.
And that number one find of 2013 is at HBU right now, waiting for the public to go and see it. And that is a scarab from the late Bronze Age, dating to the 15th century BC, which is the time of the conquest. And the reason this is so important is because this scarab confirms our pottery dating and our architectural dating that we've been doing up to this point, which essentially links in with the biblical chronology and establishes that this is indeed the Eye of Joshua's day.
Now, what's a scarab? Is that a knife or a sheath? What is that?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, a scarab is like an amulet. They're they're small, made out of stone or glass or faience or other materials, and they would have symbolism on the scarab, usually on the back, maybe the shape of a dung beetle, which in Egyptian mythology they believe the dung beetle pushed the sun across the sky each day. But on the base, there's different iconography, and on ours, it's very clearly from the time of Thutmose III, or the 18th Egyptian dynasty. And this is very important, because coins were not invented until about the 6th century B.C., so we can't use coins to help us date like you could, you know, by the time you get to New Testament times. So the scarab is even better than coins, because we can very precisely date using this scarab, which has a sphinx on it with the head of a falcon. There's an Egyptian ankh, and then a flag symbol, which represents royalty. And so we know what the years of the reign of Thutmose III were. We know when he conquered the area of Palestine or the Levant or the land of the Bible in his 22nd year. So we know that we're in the 15th century B.C., and that's very important.
That is so cool.
Well, we think so. And what was interesting about these scarabs is they were used as amulets also. You know, they could be used as a signet, something to seal, like a governor or a mayor or a client king might have a copy
of
the pharaoh's
authority.
Yeah, exactly. It represented his authority. And then also they would continue to be used in later generations as kind of like talismans or amulets.
Hmm. And then that dates that site, so you know the date that you're, what you're seeing is at that time.
That's right, because we know the date of the scarab, and it confirms the dates of the pottery and other, you know, ways that we've been using to establish the chronology. Another one, which is also at the HBU exhibit, is an infant jar burial, which we exhumed three summers ago. And in the late Bronze Age, they had a unique way of burying their dead, and in particular, infants or neonates. And that would be to place them inside of a jar with the bottom cut out, and then there would be dipper juglets nearby, which were part of the cult that they followed. We don't know exactly what they did with these dipper juglets, some sort of baptism for interment, but we also were able to exhume this, which confirmed the late Bronze Age date as well.
So interesting. Let me give information if you would like to go to the seminar or if you'd like to visit the Dunham Bible Institute at Houston Baptist University. You can go to their website to get more information. Click on hbu.edu/archaeological conference. That's hbu.edu/archaeological conference. And if you'd like, you can call and get information at 281-649-3287. That's 281-649-3287. The exhibits are on display through December at the HBU Bible Museum, the Dunham Bible Museum, and the symposium featuring Dr. Stripling and three other archaeologists from the site will be February the 8th, and you can find out about registration on that website. The deadline for registration is February the 1st, and the cost includes lunch and everything that Saturday, so it should be very interesting. And Dr. Stripling, thank you so much for your time today. So interesting. We could go on and on because I find this fascinating, but I appreciate
Well, Marcia,
the time.
Thanks for having me on, and I look forward to staying in touch with you throughout 2014.
Sounds good. Thank you, sir.